Welcome to The Same Drugs with Megan Murphy. I'm Megan Murphy. Today on the show, I'm talking to Toby Young, the London Associate Editor of Quillette, the Associate Editor of The Spectator, and the Founder and General Secretary of the Free Speech Union.
How are things going over there? What's the situation with all the lockdowns and coronavirus?
Yeah, well, I'm a lockdown skeptic, and I've started this website called lockdownskeptics.org, which is a kind of hub of lockdown skepticism, and it's become all-consuming because it's such a there's so much kind of information constantly kind of breaking about coronavirus and about the impact of lockdowns, and so many research papers being published. It's just kind of impossible to stay on top of it all, but it's become kind of, you know, my full-time job.
So what's your position?
My position is that lockdowns are almost certainly ineffective when it comes to suppressing infections and deaths. And I used to think that there was some public health benefit to locking down populations, but that the costs, both in terms of public health and the economic costs, outweigh those benefits. But I now think that there's very little public health benefit. And there's, you know, there are plenty of there's research being published every day comparing countries and states that have locked down with those that haven't, showing that the rate of mortality is no lower in those countries and states that have locked down. And, you know, some of the analyses are quite complex, involving regression analysis and so forth, which I'm struggling to get my head around. But it's, you know, I find the whole thing completely fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit obsessed too with the whole thing. I mean, it's been like, it's been strange and obviously not great, let's say, but it's been like super interesting to watch and analyze at the same time. I guess my position has been that, I mean, the lockdowns I've largely supported just because of the you know, trying to avoid overwhelming the healthcare system angle. At this point, here where I am in BC in Canada, we've essentially flattened the curve. So I feel like, okay, let's start opening things up again, because the main point was to avoid, you know, really screwing up the healthcare system. So I think that we've gotten to a place where we can start letting people out again. And, you know, like, people who are vulnerable still have to, you know, be really careful and protect themselves, I suppose. But I feel like, I guess the purpose is less to avoid getting everyone infected than the healthcare system issue, because at the end of the day, I mean, we don't know when a vaccine's going to come. We don't know if it's going to work. But anyway.
Yeah. And I think the infection fatality rate was initially believed to be higher than it is by the epidemiologists and virologists advising governments around the world. And the more surveying we do to see how many people have actually been exposed to the virus and how many people have got antibodies, the more we keep revising downwards the infection fatality rate. So that's another reason why the cost of the lockdowns isn't worth it.
Oh, okay. So you think that, like, not that many people are at risk of getting infected to begin with? Is that what you mean?
No, I think that people are very much at risk of getting infected, but their risk of succumbing to COVID-19 if they're exposed to infection is very low. I think it's less than 0.5%, so less than 1 in 200, probably closer to 1 in 400 or 1 in 500, which kind of alters the cost-benefit equation. I don't think that we should just do nothing, but more modest restrictions, such as maintaining 2 meters apart, washing our hands frequently, wearing masks in public, and so forth, they seem to be just as effective as the more severe restrictions that governments have imposed and which are going to do such extraordinary economic damage and are already doing quite a lot of public health damage.
I see. Okay. Well, I did want to get away from coronavirus. I can't. It's impossible. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. I'm really excited, and I really appreciate it, by the way.
That's a pleasure.
So I guess mainly, I mean, there's a million things that I'd love to talk to you about, but mainly today I think I wanted to talk to you about free speech and no platforming. So, I mean, I watched your Oxford debate thing, and which was awesome. And I guess, I mean, what frustrates me is that people who support no platforming or kind of brush it off as no big deal, you know, for example, like they'll say that banning someone from Twitter doesn't really matter. It doesn't have a big impact. You're not really silenced. I mean, you can still talk. You can still write. In my case, obviously, I do still have a platform. I am still speaking. I haven't been, you know, banned from society. But at the same time, I do consider these things to be very serious and to have really serious implications. I guess, you know, why do you think that no platforming does matter? Why do you think that, you know, banning people from social media and things like that matter?
I guess it matters because I don't think that any particular group, however passionately they believe in their particular credo, is entitled to prevent someone else from speaking in the public square or prevent other people from listening to them. And until fairly recently, across the West, there seemed to be a pretty broad consensus about that. Free speech protections vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but generally speaking, I think everyone accepted that if you passionately disagree with a particular person, you either ignore what they're saying or you engage in argument and debate with them in the public square. You don't seek to prevent them from speaking through threat of force or by other means. Not only is that denying them their right to free speech, but it's also denying other people the right to hear them. And I guess I believe with J.S. Mill that if you think your position is correct, if you are absolutely convinced of that, then you're mistaken in believing that if someone is allowed to criticize your point of view, put another point of view, that that's going to jeopardize your point of view. Surely, if your point of view is correct, it's only going to be revealed to be more correct when it collides with the erroneous views of those who don't share it. But if it's not correct, then you should be grateful for those who challenge you and point out the errors in your point of view, because that gives you the opportunity to actually correct your point of view and believe something stronger. I guess that's broadly why I'm against no platforming.
Yeah. And I mean, that's my experience. So I really don't understand those arguments at all, because when I've debated people or when I've been challenged, you know, in the media or during Q&As, during panels and talks and stuff like that, I really enjoy it. And I'm actually really grateful to be challenged in that way, because as you say, it gives you the opportunity to further explain your position and hopefully help people, you know, better understand your argument. So I don't really get the idea that people's ideas or politics, ideologies, arguments are safer if they go unchallenged. I mean, when do you think that kind of became popularized? To me, it seems semi-recent, but I mean, I'm not positive.
Yeah, I think it's, progressives engaging in no platforming and other methods of shutting down, of silencing their opponents. I think that is a fairly new development. Of course, you know, you see that sort of thing in totalitarian communist societies. Trotsky is perhaps an early example of someone who was cancelled for dissenting from the prevailing orthodoxy within a particular group. Generally, I think desire to silence your opponents, to shut them down, to prevent them from articulating what you felt was a heretical and dangerous point of view. That, until quite recently, has been something you'd associate with conservatives, particularly the religious right, and not with people on the progressive left. So I think that's a fairly new development. And until fairly recently, the cause of free speech was a progressive cause. When the ACLU was fighting various First Amendment cases in the 1960s, the main beneficiaries of those victories were the leaders of the civil rights movement. And winning those victories was considered an important victory for the progressive movement. It's odd that in the past maybe 15 years that many people on the progressive left have lost sight of the importance of free speech and how historically important it's been to progressive groups, feminists, gays, lesbians, even transgender people. The idea that free speech is only something that benefits those in power, privileged, white, heterosexual men, is very historically ignorant. If you look at the history of various progressive struggles to win important rights for beleaguered, historically disadvantaged minorities, free speech has been their friend, not their enemy. I think Ira Glasser put it quite well. He's the ex-head of the ACLU. He said that it's tempting on a battlefield when you have the enemy in your sights to try and impose speech restrictions on them, because you think it helps your side. But he said it's a bit like releasing poison gas. The danger is that after you've released it, the wind can change. And often I say to people on the progressive left who are trying to no-platform people that whose views they disapprove of, you know, if you allow people who disagree with other people to silence them, to deprive them of their right to free speech, what guarantee do you have? Why are you so confident that once that's become the new normal, it won't then be applied to you in due course? It's not usually a convincing argument.
Yeah. Why do you think that people associate free speech with the right now? You know, even just saying free speech or advocating for free speech is sort of treated as a dog whistle for the right. You know, like since I've started talking about free speech a lot more, you know, I see people online all the time sort of implying that I'm like a secret right winger or that I'm like alt-right. And it's just because I've been, you know, talking about free speech, and also because I'm talking about people who I guess I'm supposed to have canceled, or people who aren't perfectly left-wing or left-wing at all or whatever. But, you know, I'm very open about my beliefs and whatnot, but it seems that now anybody who advocates free speech is just deemed right-wing, and I don't know why the left or progressives or feminists have decided that the right should own free speech, or have decided that they don't want to advocate for free speech themselves.
Yeah, it is puzzling. I guess the fact that lots of conservatives have taken up the cause of free speech, of course, there's an element of opportunism in that. But also, I think the experience of many conservatives over the past 15, 25 years, as they've become culturally less powerful, as they've become a minority in the mainstream media, in the entertainment industry, in the publishing industry, and so forth, certainly in academia, although that's not a particularly new development, as they've become a minority and as their own speech rights have been threatened, so they've become kind of radicalized and started to champion free speech. I think it's a really welcome development. I mean, it must feel awful for you that so many people have tried to no-platform you, sometimes successfully. But I think from the point of view of the cause of free speech, it's very helpful to have people like me, and I am a male, pale, stale conservative, make common cause with people like you. It's great that there are still some people on the progressive left who care about free speech and who are prepared to make these political alliances, because they recognize that free speech is more important than other things we might disagree about. We can go back to disagreeing about those things in due course, but for the time being, there's a really important battle to be won.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are things that we disagree on, and I'm sure there's plenty of other things that we do agree on. I mean, I've sort of come to feel that the issues are more important than the labels and the ideologies themselves, so I prefer to talk with people about issues and ideas and policies and things like that over labeling people with these broad strokes, left, right, whatever. I mean, I think that one of the things that the left does claim is that free speech will only benefit the powerful. So those who do support free speech do it because they're already, you know, privileged people. They're already people who are in power. And they do it because they want to be able to, you know, be free to say bigoted things or to oppress people. I mean, what do you think about that argument?
Well, I think it's certainly historically ignorant, because the main beneficiaries of free speech historically have been marginalized groups, not the most powerful groups. Free speech has been a weapon with which to challenge entrenched power. You can see that in the 19th century trade union movement in Britain and in America and across the Anglosphere. Trade unions in part were set up in order to protect the speech rights of their members, so they could criticize working practices that were inhumane or dangerous. They could criticize their bosses. They could criticize poverty and inequality without risking being fired. So it's just not true that free speech benefits just people like me. I think there's sometimes when you encounter that argument, there's quite a strong element of condescension in it towards those people they identify as members of victim groups. So often the people trying to no platform, people like you and me, are themselves privileged white people, often been to private schools, elite universities, and they're speaking up on behalf of members of victim groups who they imagine are going to be harmed in some way by if you're allowed to express your point of view in the public square. Now, you often don't see many members of the victim groups they're claiming to speak for standing alongside them, trying to stop you speaking. And not only is that kind of, you know, there's a sort of element of you know, the white savior about it, that they're somehow, it's important that they should protect these vulnerable people who don't have the same privileges as them, and they feel kind of you know, terribly self-important and morally virtuous in it, because they take on this protective role. But also there's something kind of completely misguided about it, as Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff point out in The Coddling of the American Mind. You're not actually doing members of so-called victim groups any favors by protecting them from intellectual challenge. First of all, it's, I think, condescending to imagine that if you happen to be African Caribbean and at a British university, you're going to be absolutely horrified and traumatized by listening to a conservative set out their stall in the public square. You know, a significant minority of African Caribbean students are themselves conservatives. The idea that if members of minorities do disagree with the views being expressed by privileged white men, that you're going to somehow be doing them a favor by preventing those people from speaking is just nonsense. Much better that they, like everyone else, should have an opportunity to defend themselves and challenge people whose views they disagree with, and not be protected from them. You know, you're not doing them any favors by trying to protect them from views that may be inimical to their interests. If you want members of victim groups to stand up for their interests robustly, then they should be exposed to the challenge. They should have an opportunity to engage in debate and argument in the public square along with everyone else.
Yeah, it is interesting because I've noticed that also, that the people who tend to lead the charge against me, who start the petitions, who protest outside my events, those people are, the majority are white. They're white women, they're white men. They're usually university students or college educated, middle class, you know. And it does, and they sort of, they use these marginalized groups to their benefit. So they use them as a shield, right? Like, so they just keep announcing these marginalized groups, mm-hmm. whoever they claim to be protecting, over and over and over. And, you know, and then are accusing those of us that they're trying to no platform of being exactly what they are. I mean, except that we're not trying to no platform people, you know, like, of course I have privilege. Of course I have white privilege. Of course it's a privilege to, like, live in Canada. You know, I live in a safe place. You know, I'm educated, so on and so forth. I'm not living in poverty. But
yeah, we published a piece in Quillette not long ago by a PhD student at Cambridge called Rob Henderson, who has come to graduate school by a very circuitous route. At one stage, I think he served in the US Army and has a similar background to J.D. Vance. I think he went to Yale before we went to Cambridge, and he describes various forms of wokeness as a form of status signaling. So to use the right words, to express your disapproval of those who don't know the right terminology, to try and stop people like Jordan Peterson from speaking on your campus, this is all a way of advertising the fact that you're a member of the kind of Brahmin class, because someone who wasn't a member of your class, someone who didn't have the same education and background and fine-tuned antennae as you, they wouldn't know, they'd be ignorant of all these codes. So in advertising your familiarity with these constantly changing, kind of incredibly difficult to navigate rules of etiquette and conduct, you're actually advertising your membership of the elite class.
Totally, totally. I think it's so elitist because I find that a lot of it is academic jargon. So the way that these leftist academics describe the left and describe leftist causes, especially online, I should say, is in these really academic terms, and they use these ideologies and these, like, jargon-filled sentences that don't make sense to anybody unless, as you say, you're in the in-group or you're college-educated. And all these political terms and all these mantras are, again, accessible to, like, a certain class of people, mostly not these marginalized groups that these people are claiming to protect, who probably don't really give a shit about what they're going on about. They're, like, long, long Twitter threads, right? I always wonder why you think that, well, first, why do you think that people who oppose free speech think that they don't need free speech, or that not having free speech won't hurt them or kind of come back to bite them in the ass at some point in their life when they want to say something controversial that others don't like?
It's partly just, I think, short-sightedness, believing that because they're in the ascendant at the moment, they will be forever, and that they'll never need the benefit of speech protections because they'll always be the dominant group. I also think that lots of people on the woke left imagine that they are, you know, revolutionaries, that they're going to transform society in some fundamental and lasting way, and that once we're living in, you know, this kind of this post-capitalist utopia, there'll be no need to have rules in place to enable groups that disagree to kind of get along and kind of negotiate with each other. There won't be politics in the kind of post-capitalist utopia. Everyone will just get along perfectly well. So they sort of, you know, I don't think they, you know, they don't really think it through particularly thoroughly, but they're like a kind of, you know, it's all, as many people have observed, there is a kind of strong religious dimension to the woke left. And I think they believe that once they've brought about this kind of nirvana that they're struggling to bring about, there won't be conflict, there won't be disagreement. It'll be a kind of Shangri-La. It's often the kind of dream of revolutionaries to imagine that there is this kind of future in which there are no outgroups anymore. There is just one glorious in-group kind of getting along famously together. And it often, you know, in nearly every case, I think they're proved wrong. And in order to try and sustain that illusion, they expel heretics and do appalling things to them.
Yeah. And I mean, and I also notice, of course, that groups who, let's call them extremist activist groups, so groups like Antifa, for example, they seem so hypocritical to me, because on one hand, they, of course, want the right not only to disagree, but to threaten violence, to threaten death, and in many cases, actually to perpetrate violence, but to say, you know, really horrible, threatening, awful things to people, about people. And all this is done, or a lot of it is done to silence. So it's done to no platform. You know, they're advocating to no platform, and they're threatening in order to try to no platform, or to scare people into silence, or to scare, you know, facilities into not hosting these people, and to scare people into not showing up to these events to hear people speak and to participate in the conversation, etc. What do you think that disconnect is?
It often feels like a kind of soft form of terrorism, doesn't it? I think one of the reasons for it, one of the reasons it seems to grow as progressive parties are defeated at the ballot box, and that happens, you know, across the Anglosphere, but also across continental Europe, in South America too, left-wing parties haven't fared very well in the past 10 years or so. You'd expect them to be doing much better given the global economic recession of 2007 to 2008. It's almost as if they having lost at the ballot box, they're now trying to use other means to prosecute their political agenda. And I often think that's part of the explanation for why people get kind of so wrapped up in these purity spirals, whether on Twitter or in knitting circles or in young adult publishing, exercising power in these kind of small closed communities. It's a way of feeling as though you're making a difference, that your politics don't add up to nothing. You may have lost at the ballot box. Donald Trump may well be re-elected later this year. The Conservatives, having won a huge majority at the last general election last year in the United Kingdom, probably win another one in 2024. They're not going to win at the ballot box. It's almost as though they've kind of abandoned that territory to the party political right. But in order to feel as though their politics are still meaningful and that they're making a difference and they're not just screaming into a void, they begin to kind of police in this really aggressive way these kind of tiny areas of life where they still can exercise some influence. And it feels almost as though it's like a form of kind of psychological compensation for kind of losing the much bigger and more important political battles.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it, actually. I wonder if you... I mean, how do you think we should deal with the fact that now social media companies... And I'm so troubled that, you know, more people are not troubled about this. People are sort of very blasé and seem to have, like, almost wholly accepted this in many ways, including and especially progressives and liberals and leftists, again. How do we deal with the fact that social media companies, you know, these wealthy, huge companies now... have such a big hold on what we say, what information we share, what information we have access to, what we're allowed to report on, what we're allowed to ask questions about and debate.
Yeah, it's I think it's a tough one for conservatives like me, because in addition to believing in free speech, we believe in free association. So we don't want the state to intervene and prevent a private company from putting rules in place, which it expects, you know, the members of an organization it might set up to subscribe to. So it's a tricky one for us, but I share your concern, and I've been trying to think through ways in which we can try and persuade platforms like YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, to be less censorious and less one-sided in their content moderation policies. I think one of the difficulties is that a lot of the content moderation is increasingly outsourced to AIs. And the AIs operate according to algorithms designed by people who haven't thought particularly carefully about what the kind of broader implications of those algorithms are for free speech. So you have these kind of AIs essentially running amok, censoring people like us, when that might not have been the intention of those who kind of originally designed them. It's not that they're kind of thinking for themselves. It's just that the algorithms are kind of blunt instruments which end up censoring people that shouldn't be censored on those platforms. But how to tackle it is a tough one. I mean, the obvious mechanism for a conservative like me, someone who believes in free markets, is that, you know, if a company is censoring one half of an important public conversation, you just set up another platform, a rival platform, which is a bit more liberal, with a small L, in the hope that that will then attract the people who are put off or excluded from the kind of prevailing platforms. And Jordan Peterson's tried to do that. He set up a new platform in the form of, I think it's called ThinkSpot, which is a rival to some other social media platforms. But the difficulty is that companies like Facebook, platforms like Twitter and YouTube are monopolies. They're so dominant. They take up such a huge amount of kind of space in people's imaginations and in the kind of culture that it's very difficult for a kind of competitor to get any sort of foothold in the market. So it's a tough question. I know you've been struggling with this because you're trying to get reinstated on Twitter. Tell me what arguments you're making to Twitter that you think might have some purchase, you might get some traction with.
I mean, it doesn't really seem like any arguments are working, but I mean, to me, it's like, I think a lot of people will respond to me when I talk about this and be like, it's just Twitter, like, who cares? It's not real. But it matters a lot to somebody like me because I'm just independent, you know? I'm not working for any organization. I'm just an independent writer, journalist, editor. You know, I have my platforms, of course, thank goodness, but you know, I wholly depend on social media platforms in order to share my work, to be in touch with people, to connect with people, to have conversations with people, to connect with interviewees, like, to connect with other writers, editors, journalists, so on and so forth. I mean, essentially what we argued, or what my lawyers argued, is that, they broke their own, terms of service and contract, you know, because they had committed to giving users 30 days notice if they were going to change the Twitter rules. And they, of course, committed to supporting free speech and not banning people based on political ideologies. And they committed to not retroactively banning people. So if they do change a rule, they can't go back and ban people for having broken that rule before they announced that they changed the rule. And they, you know, did all those things to me. You know, they changed a rule after the fact and then sort of went back and combed through some of my tweets and started locking me down and then eventually banning me for those things. And I mean, I didn't even break a rule. But so, I mean, needless to say, you know, they simply haven't been accountable. They don't really respond to my arguments, what I've said, what my lawyers have said, what other people say. They sort of say, oh, well, she was harassing trans people, which of course I was not. You know, I never said anything hateful to anybody. I don't know if they even know why I was banned or if they're just lying and they can't be bothered to really look into it or whatever. But yeah, I mean, the whole thing is really, it's frustrating to me. And it, again, it's frustrating that people sort of aren't taking seriously the impact that this kind of bias and this kind of silencing has on public discourse and public debate, and the fact that, you know, places like Twitter have real impacts on elections. You know, this is also where politicians speak and share their messages. And it is where it's the public square, essentially, now. And it does matter whether we like that or not.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
One thing we can do is try and increase the cost of prohibiting people like you from being on Twitter. You know, if we can make Twitter's life as difficult as possible for acting in ways like that, then ultimately they're less likely to act like that. I think often they're not doing it because ideologically they've decided to side with the trans lobby rather than gender critical feminists on this particular issue, although it often feels that way. It's more that the trans lobby are just kind of noisier and more troublesome, and they just want to avoid that trouble, so they'll do their bidding. If we can be as noisy and as troublesome on the other side, then that may tilt the balance a bit the other way. The other thing we can do is to organize. I've set up something called the Free Speech Union. You can see the banner over my shoulder, and we describe it as a nonpartisan mass membership organization that stands up for the speech rights of its members. And the idea in part is to try and organize, to try and band together so we can act in concert, the same kind of general principle underpinning the trade union movement in the 19th century and the birth of trade unions. If we can band together and act to defend one another's interests and act in concert, then we can begin, I think, to defend some of the speech rights that are currently being denied us as individuals.
Yeah, I think you're right. I do think that we need to be more organized and to take more organized action around these kinds of things. Obviously, individuals get mad and say all sorts of things online, but I think that you're right. I think that for whatever reason, these groups are able to pressure and have a lot of power in this regard. I know you have to get going. I'll just ask you one final question. And thanks for bringing that up. I was going to ask you about the Free Speech Union also, of course. I wonder if you think there's anything that's off the table. You know, should there be hate speech laws? Is there such a thing as hate speech? Is there anything, you know, people should not be allowed to say, I suppose?
I'm fairly permissive. I'm suspicious of hate speech laws. There is a new hate speech law that's just been introduced in the Scottish Parliament. It's a hate crime bill, but it criminalizes inciting hatred. Until now, that offence has been confined to inciting hatred against racial groups, but it's going to be extended to include a range of protected characteristics, including gender identity. And there are some free speech protections built in. So if you criticise religion or different sexual practices, you can make a free speech defence if you're accused of inciting hatred against, say, a religious group. But that defence isn't available to you if you're accused of inciting hatred against, say, trans people. So it's a pretty worrying development. And I'm just talking to some of the lawyers involved with the Free Speech Union about what we can do to oppose that. I mean, I think I draw the line in the same place that the First Amendment of the US Constitution draws the line, which is essentially that all speech is permitted save for that speech which is a direct incitement to violence. Short of that, I think speech should be permitted. And I think the burden of proof should very much fall on those that want to stop us from exercising our right to free speech rather than those of us who want to exercise that right. So if you want to no-platform someone, you're going to have to demonstrate that allowing them to speak would imminently lead to violence being committed against a particular individual or a particular group. You can't say it's likely to or could or in certain circumstances might, you have to show that it will. And short of being able to do that, you shouldn't be able to stop the person from speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Okay, awesome. Thank you so much for your time. It was so great to talk with you. I hope that we get a chance to talk again. And take good care.
Thanks, Megan. Thanks a lot. Really good to talk to you. And you must join the Free Speech Union.
I will. I'm on it. I'm going to do it.
Great.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.